Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing Board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Welcome to Most Notorious. I'm Eric Rivenis, and I appreciate you taking a little chunk of your precious time to spend with me here. Incredible wealth, a scoundrel with no morals, arsenic. Words that, when used together, never end well. But it is our subject on this week's episode. We're talking about one of these high society stories where pure, unchecked greed is taken to extraordinary heights. It's with great pleasure that I introduce my guest this week, Tobin T. Book. Tobin is one of the premier historical crime writers in Michigan and has a special talent for digging up absolutely fascinating true crime stories, many lost in time. We're discussing today Poisoning the Pecks, the scandalous 1916 murder plot. Really good stuff. Thank you, Tobin Book, for your time today. You're a historical true crime writer from Michigan. For those who aren't familiar with Michigan crime, can you give us some of the state's more notorious history?
Yeah. Well, Michigan's got kind of an inglorious past as far as true crime is concerned. We're a typical Midwestern state as far as crime is concerned. I mean, you're going to have, you know, your murders and things like that. But the one thing that does make Michigan a little bit different than other places is its geographic location. We're so close, Detroit's so close to Canada, that during Prohibition era, it became probably the nation's number one importer of illegal hooch. The stuff came in, I understand Capone wanted to take over Detroit because it was such an illegal pipeline of booze coming into the United States. You're just a river away, basically. But he was so terrified of the Purple Gang that he did business with them instead, and I think his Log Cabin brand of whiskey was whiskey that was imported through the Purple Gang in Detroit. So there's that. And we've had some real notables. Beck and Fernandez, the Lonely Hearts Killers, were caught in Michigan. They were ultimately tried and executed for a New York crime. But so it's an interesting case in that they were caught for a crime that they committed, but they were never tried for, and that happened in Michigan. So we've had our share of serial killers and all kinds of fun stuff.
So one of the main victims in your book, John Peck, is from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Can you talk a little bit about John Peck, who he was?
Yeah, John Peck was a native New Yorker, and he and his second wife relocated to Grand Rapids. I think they were looking for a quiet place to settle. When they came to mid-Michigan, the city of Grand Rapids was undergoing a population boom because there was the furniture industry had gone into full swing. And what Peck's business was is he was a manufacturer of medicines, which is he learned from his pharmacist father in New York. The Peck brothers, he and his brother Thomas, eventually became drug wholesalers to all of West Michigan. And then he used his fortune to invest in furniture companies and banks. He became president of at least one bank that I know of. And so it snowballed. So by 1916, John Peck had amassed a fortune that was in the seven figures, which was huge in that era.
Let's talk more about John Peck's family. Who are the family members important to this story?
John and Hannah Peck were the mom and dad of, they were the parents of three children. One of them died as a teenager, so she was gone by the time this story takes place. The older surviving son was named Percy, and his little sister was named Clara Louise. So those would be the four Pecks. Now, Percy had a wife named Ella, and he had several children. Clara, by 1915, had not been married yet.
So introduce Arthur Waite to us. Who was he, and what was his background?
Arthur Warren Waite was the son of a fruit and vegetable wholesaler, humble roots. Ironically, they lived in a relatively modest abode, but it was relatively close to the mansion that Clara Louise grew up in. So they were geographically not that far apart. He was kind of the all-American boy, athlete, a baseball player, actor in the drama club for his high school, very, very good-looking guy. He had a sinister side, though, that he had done a very good job covering up. He had, by the time that he married Clara Louise Peck, he had a long string of thefts. There are some stories that he had killed some animals in his youth. He cheated his way, lied and cheated his way through high school, and got into the University of Michigan's dental program, and he lied and cheated his way through that.
Yeah, and he basically conned his way into a degree, didn't he?
Yeah, he actually did manage to get a dental degree, but Wellman and Bridgman was a British dental firm, and they scouted folks from the University of Michigan's dental program. So to get a job with Wellman and Bridgman, though, since it was a British company, Waite had to have some postgraduate work at a British university, and he didn't really want to go back to school. So he sort of doctored his transcripts to make it look like he had some graduate work when he didn't. He did a quickie course at the University of Glasgow, Scotland, and then he went off to South Africa to work as a dentist. And his wayward ways continued in Africa. He stole dental gold. From my research, he stole basically everything that he could steal. And I know that he got into some trouble with a woman over there, too, and had to pay his way out of it, although the actual details of that have been kind of lost to history. So somewhere around 1914, he came back to the United States, ostensibly to avoid World War I, but I think it may have been more to do with the fact that he got himself into some legal entanglement with an unmentioned woman over there. So he comes back to the United States, and for the outside world, he becomes a dental surgeon in New York City, comes back to Grand Rapids, and the city heralds him as kind of like a rags-to-riches success story. They run an article about all of this, and it's really kind of a sham. But he uses it as credibility to get into the Peck household. And it turns out, as the investigation unfolds, investigators discovered that he wasn't even licensed to practice in New York or anywhere else for that matter. And all these dental surgeries that he was telling Clara and everybody else he was doing were just in his mind.
But by the time he begins his courtship to Clara Louise, none of this is known by anyone publicly. And he's a really smooth-talking, handsome guy. And he completely sweeps Clara Louise off of her feet.
He does. And it's interesting because I don't think she was no dullard. And I think that, I don't know, call it a sixth sense or whatever, but I think that there was something that raised her suspicions about him. She wasn't as sold on him as her mother was. And Hannah had kidney trouble, so she had told her daughter that she wanted to see her married before she died. And so I think Wade is the consummate con man, and he understands people real well. And he understands that the key to Clara Louise's heart is her mother. So he courts the mother as much as he does the daughter, really. He goes to their mansion here in Grand Rapids, and he sits in the sitting room with the mother. They have tea. He puts on a British accent and tells about his days as a healer, a dentist in South Africa with the underprivileged there. And Hannah had a background as a Quaker and had a very, very strong relationship with philanthropic endeavors here in Grand Rapids. And so that, you know, he knew that that was a button he could push. If he had painted himself as this great humanitarian, that he could worm his way into her heart, and she was the key to Clara. So Clara actually rejected him at first, but he sort of pressed it. And at some point in time, I think she just couldn't say no. Tell you, interesting about Wade, you know, he's a good looking guy. And for a father of daughters like myself, it's a cautionary tale that borders on really terrifying, because you never really know what you're going to get. I think they said that another good example of this is Ted Bundy. I think Bundy was known as being a real smooth talker, silver tongue, good looking guy.
Yeah, and H.H. Holmes comes to mind as well. Another handsome, charming man who managed to disarm and sweet talk whoever he came into contact with.
I've done quite a bit of writing and research about folks like this. I wrote a book called The Shocking Case of Helmy Schmidt, who was a bluebeard. He was using matrimonial advertisements, and then he moonlighted as a spy during an Imperial German spy during World War One. And Schmidt and a guy named Powers, who's another one, and Raymond Fernandez, these were people who were incredibly manipulative. And an interesting thing that I found, an interesting strand connecting Schmidt with Raymond Fernandez, who's half of the Lonely Hearts duo, is that they actually used intimates in their life as accomplices in their scheme. They passed their intimates off and lovers off as sisters. Both of them did this, actually. In fact, Schmidt went so far as to pass off his current wife as a sister when he was meeting prospective marks. And you think, my God, who would go along with that scheme? But that's how manipulative and effective these people are in toying with others.
And in your book, you hint that Arthur Waite was planning to do what he did to Clara's parents before he even began pursuing her.
Yeah, and I think that an interesting piece of evidence in this regard is they found, during the investigation, they found a classmate of his, and had actually obtained a textbook, a reference book that Waite was using at the University of Michigan as an undergraduate student there. And the pages involving arsenic were dog-eared and flipped through. Arsenic was used by dentists at the time, I believe, to kill nerves during root canal surgeries. And other dental students told investigators that this was a very minor part of the curriculum, but Waite seemed to really be interested in arsenic. And I think that when one of the investigators involved in this, Assistant District Attorney George Brothers, who came to Grand Rapids, he's kind of an interesting character in his own right. Anyways, he had told the press that when Waite came back from South Africa in 1914, he went heiress hunting. So I think that he had this plan. I almost kind of suspect that he may have tried something similar to this in Africa, which may have led to the female. I think he called it a woman trouble that he had to buy his way out of. But I'm kind of convinced in my mind, based on my research, and it's a bit speculative, but I think he probably had either tried this before or had it planned for a long, long time.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it from the case you present. And besides arsenic, another one of his hobbies was the study of bacteria.
Yeah, that's probably the most fascinating piece of his case. And it's brilliant. He obtained these virulent germs from typhus and typhoid and streptococcus, and his plan was to infect the pecs with these substances, and therefore if an autopsy was conducted, they would reveal nothing more than a natural cause of death. It turns out that his apartment, he didn't have the laboratory conditions to keep these germs dangerous enough, so he had to go to the old tried and true arsenic.
So Arthur Waite marries Clara Louise and befriends her mother, Hannah Peck. And not long after they tie the knot, Hanapek is dead. Can you talk about how that happened?
Yeah, the Pecks were going to come and visit Clara and Arthur, who were living in a, I think it's a 7-bedroom apartment overlooking Central Park. Real swanky place. I mean, like one of the swankiest places in the city. And Hannah and John decided they were going to come and visit, but I guess John couldn't come because he had been delayed by business affairs. He was on a bunch of boards of directors. He couldn't come, so Hannah came to New York, and she went to the apartment, the Wade apartment, and immediately became sick. She died within a few days, and it didn't really shock a whole lot of people because she had nephritis, so she had some serious kidney ailments. So it didn't shock anybody. The one thing that was shocking to the family was that the last person who saw her alive, she had said to him, and this would be Arthur Warren Waite, she said to him, "My last wish is to be cremated." And nobody in her family had ever heard her express an interest in cremation. Now, the death occurred in the early hours of on a Sunday in January, and she was brought back to Grand Rapids for an at-home funeral, as was customary at the time. Then her body was taken up to Detroit, or down to Detroit, and cremated. Cause of death unknown. It was just presumed to be a kidney failure. But Percy had heard that her eyes were, Clara had relayed to Percy that Hannah's eyes were dilated, which is one symptom. It's probably a symptom of a lot of things, but it's one symptom of a drug overdose. And they found a significant quantity of cocaine when they searched the Wade apartment. And cocaine will dilate the eyeballs, like the eyes like that, the pupils of the eyes. So Percy, who had a background in dentistry as well and knew a little bit about chemistry because I think he had a degree in pharmacy now that I think about it, and his dad was a pill maker, so he knew the effect of substances on the body. He suspected that Waite had overdosed her with cocaine. One way or another, though, he murdered her. He admitted to it later on.
And he's not satisfied with the death of Hannah.
He needs the money, and so I think he was going to, you know, his plan was to systematically eliminate John and Hannah Peck, and then eventually Clara was going to have to go. And the way they had the will set up is that when John and Hannah passed away, the money would be distributed equally to the two kids, Percy and Clara. Now, there's some sketchy evidence that he actually had planned to do in Percy as well. The interesting thing about that, and I kind of doubted it for a while, but an interesting thing about that is I'm not sure if he had done in Percy, the money would have gone to Percy's kids. But as some locals here, some old timers recently told me that there was a rumor going on a long time that Waite had planned to take the kids down to Reed's Lake and drown them. In which case, if he had wiped out that entire branch of the Peck family tree, you would have inherited the full Monty, all of it. So it's interesting, but I mean, at the very least, he was going to poison his two in-laws and his wife.
For a guy that's so intelligent, it's hard to believe that he imagined he could get away with one murder after another so quickly and not draw suspicion.
Yeah, it is very, very fascinating. You know, he tried to paint himself off as being soulless, what we might call a sociopath. The term that they would have used at the time was a moral idiot, although even in 1916, that term would have been a little bit passé. But it's hard to know for sure because, you know, a lot of killers will go off to prison and no matter what the evidence is, they will go and they will tell the world that they're innocent. For all the world, they're innocent. They'll give a smoking gun, but they'll tell everybody they're innocent. Waite's case was a little bit opposite. His whole entire life hinged, because New York had a death penalty, hinged on the idea that he was going to try to convince people that he was soulless, in fact, a sociopath, to use our term. And so when he got up and testified, not only did he admit to it, be admitted to it in graphic detail, and almost certainly exaggerated. So it's hard to know exactly where truth and fiction kind of where the dividing line is, the bright line is between that. It's a unique case that way, and it's studied by a lot of students of law because of that facet of it. And the prosecuting attorney, Swan, but it was brothers who actually did the questioning, His job was to usually a prosecutor would try to show the defense defendant as being depraved. And in this case, he had to try to show him as being less depraved, because if Wade had convinced everybody he was crazy, he would have not gone to prison and an electric chair. He'd gone to Bellevue and probably even got out and I suspect tried all over again.
So before we talk about the murder of John Peck, I want to bring up another interesting side relationship that he was developing with another family member, Clara and Percy's aunt Catherine Peck. Now, she was absolutely smitten with him, and he was working an angle with her as well.
Well, his relationship with her was very similar, I think, to Hannah Peck, in that he did ingratiate himself. He used his charms, turned his charms on. But it wasn't because he really liked her. It was because he needed her. And I think he needed her. I think she was his piggy bank, essentially, because he wasn't making any money as a dentist. And the lifestyle he had, the cost of it would have transcended what allowance was given to him by the Pecks. So the question always comes up, how did he afford all of this? And I think that in comes Catherine Peck. She had turned over some securities to him, and he was buying and selling fast and quick. And I think he was living on the proceeds of that. He also went so far as to pry some jewels out of some settings that she had and sold the stones, and so he made money that way. Eventually, she had a secondary, more sinister purpose for him. She became kind of a guinea pig in his experiments. I think that what he believed would happen, since she didn't have children and her favorite was Clara, that if he got rid of her, all of what she owned would go to Clara. So if he got rid of Hannah and John, then all of what they, half of what they owned would go to Clara, and Clara would be sitting on a nest egg. Then all he had to do was remove Clara from the scene, and he would have inherited half of John and Hannah's money, as well as all of Aunt Catherine's money. And she functioned as a guinea pig. He tried all kinds of things on her. He spiked her. One of the interesting stories about her is that he spiked her favorite marmalade with ground glass. And she lived to testify about all this, because her life essentially was spared when Hannah Peck came to town, because he immediately turned his attentions to Hannah. But she lived to tell about it. She testified about this marmalade, and it was her favorite marmalade from a deli around the corner, and it had like a gritty sand taste to it. So she took it back, and the deli owner was absolutely stymied as how that could have happened. And it turned out it was Wade had adulterated it with broken glass. And then he, by his own admission, he spiked her other food with fecal material. I'll let you figure out where that came from, and some other things. But again, herein lies the rub about Arthur Warren Wade. Is the primary witness to all this, the only witness to it is Arthur Warren Wade himself, and he almost certainly exaggerated his claims.
And despite all these admissions from Wade, Aunt Catherine still stuck by him.
She did. She stuck by him for an embarrassingly long time, and so did Clara. And the interesting thing about Clara is, even when presented with what we might consider concrete evidence that Wade had done in her parents, she was just did everything she could to indemnify him until she found out about the other woman. And at that point in time, she more or less condemned her husband and turned her back on him as well. It's interesting. I think that's a testament to how slick he really was with his lies. I mean, he had really convinced people.
So before we get to this exorbitant lifestyle and this other woman who plays so prominently in the investigation, let's talk about John Peck's death. How did it go down?
Yeah, John Peck was grieving and lonely, I think, and he decided to come to the Waite apartment to spend some time with Clara, and he immediately became sick. Now, I think that Waite tried to spike his soup with various bacteria cultures. There was a maid named Dora Hilliard who told the prosecutor that she had seen him dump something in the soup with vials and things, but he got mildly sick, but he didn't become deathly ill. At that point in time, Waite turned arsenic and gave him a pretty heavy dose over a series of days, and he died. And interestingly enough, he died also in the early morning hours of Sunday. Suspiciously, he told Waite that his last wish was to be cremated, which really threw everybody for a loop, because like Hannah before him, no one had ever heard John Peck mention cremation. The body was quickly embalmed by an embalmer named Eugene Oliver Kane, and it was sped to Grand Rapids for the at-home funeral. Now, at this point in time, Clara's too sick to even go to her own father's funeral. And at that point in time, she was infected. Typhus, I think. Waite had these atomizers that he gave to the Pecks to use, and certainly his wife too. And I think that's how he infected Clara. Now, the body was going to be taken to Detroit for cremation, but while they were speeding towards Grand Rapids, a telegram from a mysterious Kay Adams beat them to the station and advised Percy. It was addressed to Percy and Ella Peck, John and Hannah's son, to take charge of the body and demand an autopsy. And at that point in time, the investigation started to unfold.
And that really was the key. He might have actually gotten away with John's murder had that telegram not arrived just in the nick of time.
Yeah, his timing was good. He had murdered John and both Hannah at a time when prosecutors' offices were closed in New York City, and he could get the body out of town fast. I think he confessed. Well, I don't think he confessed later that the arsenic had caused John Peck to go into a great amount of pain, and he was calling out. So he went in with some chloroform and put a pillow over his head and smothered him. But it's a chicken or an egg scenario. I mean, they found enough arsenic in Peck's system to kill a bunch of people. But if it had not been for that telegram, he would have gotten away with it. Certainly, there were some suspicions raised. Percy was very suspicious. But John Peck, despite what the newspaper said at the time, the newspapers reported that he was hale, he was in great health. It's not true. He had some heart trouble, and in a previous vacation the family took, he had to stop his vacation earlier to come up to a sanitarium and rest due to his heart trouble. Also, the fact that a widower who had spent all these years with a wife, it was not uncommon for one partner to follow the other to the grave, so to speak, you know, just the grieving processes. And so I think that there were some eyebrows raised, but not enough to warrant the full-scale investigation if it wasn't for that telegram. And then with the telegram, people started, you know, put things together, and eventually they did the autopsy and they found the arsenic, so...
Arthur Waite, during this time, is not slowing down on his premeditations either. He comments to Clara at one point that Percy is looking sick and could well be dead soon. And then he tells Clara, too, that she looks to be at death's door. And despite the fact that she might not live very long, he promises to take care of her to the end. So his mental manipulations on poor Clara were really incredibly devious.
Yeah, he preempted it, and I think Waite just liked to. I mean, I think he kind of reveled in his own plot. And he made a comment to the Undertaker that there'll be another one here that's going to die soon, things like that. And I know that after the at home funeral, which Clara couldn't attend, he went back to the hotel where they were staying in Grand Rapids, and he stood over Clara's shoulder and watched her, actually at his command, dictate her will on hotel stationery. And she was like her mother. She was a very philanthropic, very generous individual. And she was going to give several thousand dollars to charities. And he was miffed about that. And he demanded that she rewrite the will and cut her bequests in half. So he was preempting her death already by that point in time.
So
he had said something to her like, Clara, You never know when these things, all this death around us, you never know when somebody else is going to fall sick and die. So we need to take care of each other. You know, I've taken care of you and I've got things set up so you're going to be all right, but you need to make sure that you set things up so I'm going to be okay. You know, so that type of thing.
Back after a word from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the golden age of piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilley, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we have returned to the interview.
The family was very fortunate and blessed to have some really caring friends in their court. Their minister, among others, who actually helps spearhead some of the initial investigation. Could you talk about how the investigation ramps up and some of the detectives and prosecutors that become involved in the case?
Yeah, the investigation got going with that autopsy with a local doctor, and the family consulted with Wishart, who was the reverend that married Clara and Arthur, and he was a little bit of a spark plug. Interesting individual. He actually had staged a debate with Clarence Darrow at one point in time after all of this. Just a very charismatic individual in his own right, and I think that he took it personally that he had tied the knot that essentially led to the undoing of the Pecks, or potentially. So Wishart and the doctor here went off to New York City to sort of conduct after consulting with Percy, to sort of conduct their own personal investigation. Meanwhile, Percy hired Raymond Schindler, who was a really well-known private investigator who was trained by William Burns of the Burns Detective Agency. And I think Burns was at one point in time Pinkerton. And Burns opened up he became a world-famous investigator in the West Coast. So Schindler was to keep an eye on Waite's movements in New York City while the Wishart and the doctor went poking around to see what they could find. and they interviewed all kinds of people. So eventually, when they accumulated enough information, they consulted with Swan and Brothers, who were the New York prosecutors, and they started to they opened up an official line of investigation. After Wishart had handed over his case file, and the Reverend's a really fascinating character. Whenever I write a story like this, there's always a character that just sort of emerges that I never expected. And Wishart is one of those. I mean, a Reverend who would don a fedora and even lie, which he said he felt duly guilty about, to try to get information. Kind of an interesting character in his own right. And when all was said and done, Wishart, I think, died. Don't quote me on this date, but I think it's 1933. It says in the book. When he died, they ran a real nice obituary for him in, I want to say, the New York Times. He was a New Yorker by birth. And they said that one of his crowning achievements in his career was bringing an end to the horrific crimes of Arthur Warren Waite. But they said that he went one step too far. They said that in his zealousness to solve the case, he and the doctor who did the autopsy stole the body from the crypt at the cemetery here in Grand Rapids, which is an utter falsehood. He never did it. Just kind of funny how, you know, how much credit he is given for solving that particular case. So with the two locals, the Grand Rapids and the investigators, they start trailing Waite, and Waite knows, he's like you said, he's a smart guy. He knows that he's being shadowed. So he goes to this exorbitant lengths to try to cover his tracks, and in doing so, gives them even more evidence. Essentially, almost in one instance, he hands them evidence of his own guilt. And what I'm referring to here is when he has Schindler write out an order to bribe the maid, Dora Hillier, to say she didn't see him dump anything into John Peck's soup.
Investigators are able to fend off Waite for a short time, while they send the stomach off to the University of Michigan.
Yeah, the U of M at the time had a toxicology laboratory that I think was a world leader in forensics toxicology in the very early days of forensic toxicology. And that Victor Vaughn, who was the one who examined the stomach and then later the brain tissue that was taken from the second autopsy, he had worked a lot of poisoning cases here in Michigan. There have been a few involving arsenic and strychnine. One of my previous publications was about a lady named Mary McKnight who poisoned all kinds of people with strychnine, which is a really strange poison to use because it leaves some very telltale signs. But Vaughn had a lot of experience with this type of thing, going quite a bit, going way back.
So there's a lot of arsenic in the stomach. They've got proof of poisoning, but now they need to connect Waite to the arsenic.
Yeah, well, arsenic may have been the cause of death. It would have been, certainly, if he had lived long enough to process it all. Waite said that he snuffed him with a pillow. So it's like I said before, forensically, you know, either one of them would have killed him. It's just a matter of which one was actually the culprit. It was not the arsenic in the stomach, though, that really did in Arthur Warren Waite. It was the arsenic that was discovered in the brain tissue. See, for years and years, arsenic was used by embalmers as the heavy metal is a way of arresting decomposition. So arsenic and strychnine was used in embalming fluid. But because of some real famous cases involving poisoners who used that as a forensic alibi, you know, the arsenic got it in the stomach because the embalmer used it in the embalming fluid. New York outlawed the use of arsenic and strychnine in embalming fluid, and all the other states followed suit. Waite tried to bribe the undertaker to say that he used an old formula with arsenic in it. But what really did Waite in, and this is he understood his criminal history very, very well, but what he didn't understand or account for was the fact that by 1916, forensic science had evolved to the point where they could tell if somebody had ingested arsenic before or after death, and it was by taking sections of the brain. If the presence of arsenic was in the brain, then it was proof pudding that the person ingested arsenic before death, and it could not have solely been introduced by an embalming fluid. So to that end, the doctors went, when the New York investigators got involved, they sent a team to Grand Rapids to conduct a second autopsy. Now, the body had been held in a holding vault at the cemetery. They removed the body and they removed the brain, and the brain went to Victor Vaughn as well, Dr. Vaughn, for examination. They found arsenic there, and that was it. There was just no way of ever saying that it got there by any other means. So you'd asked about the link between weight and arsenic. Now, it seems to be in cases like this of criminal poisoning, there's a kind of a sequence that needs to be established. The first in the sequence is that the person did in fact die of arsenic. The autopsy of the stomach certainly indicated that. The autopsy of the brain proved it. The second step then is to prove that Waite had access to the arsenic. Now, he couldn't get it by himself at this point in time. He had to go through another doctor to acquire it, and in doing so, he had to sign a poison register. And they found the poison register. They found the pharmacist who sold it to him, and he told them that he wanted to kill some noisome cats with the arsenic. So they had that linking Waite to the arsenic. The third piece is malice aforethought. They had to prove that Waite had the opportunity to give this chemical to the Pecks with the intention of murdering them, and that comes. Dora Hillier, the maid, who said that she had saw him spiking their soup with a white crystalline substance. So they had him kind of dead to right, which is why when he gave his first confession, he tried to come up with some crazy story about, yeah, I did buy the arsenic, and I bought it for the purpose of giving it to John Peck because he was distraught over the loss of his wife Hannah and he wanted to commit suicide, which everybody knew was crazy.
The family immediately realizes Clara is in danger, so they devise a plan to separate her from him. Can you explain what happens?
He comes back to New York, and they don't want her anywhere near him because the Peck family now at this point in time, the survivors, they're on to his plan. They're really terrified that if she goes back to New York with her husband, he's going to kill her.
Right.
And in fact, had already begun his attempts at that point in time. So they come up with a ruse. They tell Arthur that she has to stay back in Grand Rapids to fill out some paperwork so that she can inherit the money following her parents' death. They figure there's no way he's going to say no to that because he really wants the money.
Right.
So he goes back to New York. She stays in Grand Rapids where she is quite ill. And this is taking place at the same time the investigation is unfolding.
And she,
so yes, the family wanted her away from him. And she's unbelievably so loyal at this point in time.
Yep.
But like I said, it's when she discovers that there's another woman. Waite's deception was so complete. He had a second wife, really, that he installed in the Plaza Hotel. And instead of going to do these dental surgeries during the day, he was actually spending the days with Mrs. Margaret Horton, who he had installed in this hotel under the name of Mrs. A.W. Walters. And she was, for all intents and purposes, his other wife.
And that is a pretty crazy relationship. Arthur Waite's mistress has a husband who is very happily benefiting from his wife's trysts with Waite. At one point, Aunt Catherine gives Arthur Waite $8,000 to invest. And the next day, that $8,000 shows up in his girlfriend's husband's bank account, and investigators are able to link him to her with that.
Yeah, because I think he had some financial difficulties at that point in time. And there was some New York news, you know, at the time, you know, how sensationalized the press was. They opined that Waite was actually paying, that she was like a high-priced courtesan and that he was paying for her favors, essentially. But I think in reality, she had planned to run off to Europe with him, with his purloined fortune, although she claims she knew nothing about any of it. Interesting thing about that is when all of this came down and she was unveiled essentially as Mrs. A.W. Walters, her husband supplied the police with some photographs. One of them is a studio photograph that is in the Library of Congress. She was a would-be vaudevillian, you know, she dreams of becoming a stage actress. And so she had these studio photographs. And on the back of that photograph in the Library of Congress is a phone number and a name. And it's the same name and phone number that Waite, of the man, the pharmacist, that Waite got the arsenic from. And there was something else linking her to Waite's plots. She had told investigators, because they grilled her and grilled her, because they figured she was his accomplice all the way through. She told investigators that she went with Waite when he went to buy germs, and he put them in a microscope, and she made some kind of comment about how they wiggled a lot. And they even had found the clerk who sold these things to Waite and identified her as the woman that came along. So one of the mysteries of the case is, I mean, how much did she know? Now, she turned state's evidence very reluctantly. That comes through the trial transcripts, even though they're Q&A. That comes right through, the tone comes right through the language. She is a real reluctant witness. She doesn't want to do it. But she turned state's evidence. And I'm wondering how much of her complicity got covered up in that. Unless she was that out to lunch. She could have been. It's hard to say for sure.
So obviously all this evidence mounts up, and there's no question that Waite does John and Hannah Peck in. Waite does have some defenders, his father and brother Frank specifically. And Frank Waite is a really sympathetic character in the story. He knows his brother murdered the Pecks, but does love his brother deeply, one of the few to stand by him, and does whatever he can to ensure that his brother won't fry. So he convinces Arthur Waite to make a full confession in hopes that he'll be granted some leniency for his cooperation.
Yeah, and I think there was no question with the Waites at this point in time that Arthur was guilty. I mean, and it was embarrassing to them. I mean, he was the all-American boy, and he was applauded here in Grand Rapids, and then he turns out to be this lascivious deviant who plotted the death of these folks in cold blood. And the Pecks were not, I don't think, your prototypical wealthy folks either. They're very down-to-earth people and very well-loved in their community. There wasn't that kind of uppity, you know, reputation that other folks in their era had regarding their wealth. They were affluent, incredibly affluent, but I don't think you'd know it to talk to them. And so Waite had murdered these people who were very, very well-liked, very gentle, very giving people. They shared their wealth around, and the family was embarrassed, I think. And yeah, they had brokered to deal with Swan, who's an interesting character too, with Tammany Hall connections. Just a guy you wouldn't want to mess with. I mean, if you see photographs of him, you think, geez, you know, this is not a guy, very serious individual, not the type that you'd want to ever tangle with. But they get him to agree to take the death penalty off the table if Waite confesses. And in comes the story about the phantom that's in his ear. The little black man, I think, is with the little black man from Egypt. And again, he knew his criminal history because this is the exact same ruse that was tried by a previous criminal. And at that point in time, what he's doing is he's preempting a insanity plea. And the whole deal with getting the death penalty off was that he was to admit to it. Now he says that he did it, but his hand was forced by this phantom that was in his ear that told him to do, I think the quote is, to do bad always. So at that point in time, the Waites, their attempts sort of fell apart, unfortunately for Frank, who was quite an emotional fellow and did stay by his brother's side, despite he knew he was guilty. He, right down to the end, there was Frank, the one family member that visited him in Sing Sing. During the trial, the father and the brother also tried to establish a pattern of insanity that ran through one branch of the Waite family as a way of trying to keep Arthur out of the chair, which was a futile attempt, ultimately.
Can you talk about some of the highlights of the trial and the eventual verdict?
Yeah, Clara got up and testified. The juror said that the two most moving witnesses, convincing witnesses, were Clara and Waite's father, which is interesting. But Clara was definitely a highlight because she gave the jurors and the outside world a real good look at his duplicity. She talked in great detail about all these fantastic surgeries that he supposedly did, even going so far as taking her to the hospital, leaving her in the car while he runs in to come out an hour later. And he's done this amazing surgery of a jaw and yada, yada, yada. And it was just fake. Another interesting one to testify was Margaret Horton, who turned state's evidence, and she testified about letters that no longer existed. And these were letters that Waite had sent her from prison. And in these letters, he had made comments undermining his own insanity defense, comments like, "I've got them all fooled. I'm going to get put in Bellevue, and then I'll get out. We'll go off to Italy together," things like that. He also undermined the little phantom from Egypt story. But the letters had been destroyed, so she was asked to recall them, which is an interesting bit of hearsay testimony that probably wouldn't fly in a jury today with a trial today. The juror said that Margaret Horton, though, wasn't the most convincing witness. One, she was a hostile witness, which I think is real interesting from my perspective. The give and take between her and brothers is at some point in time downright contentious. But the juror said that she had too big of a stake in the game. She wasn't too very credible. Another interesting witness who testified was Kay Adams, who turns out to be the niece of Dr. Jacob Cornell. And she was the one that sent the telegram that got the whole thing going. And they were friends of the family. And essentially, she testified that she put one and one together and came up with the idea that the Pecks may have been poisoned. But she also said that there was a man who asked her to write that telegram. And when she was asked who directed it, the testimony was cut off. And so that's an enduring mystery as to who the hand actually was that moved the pseudonymous Kay Adams. I think it was probably Dr. Jacob Cornell, who was an old family friend of the Pecks. Another real interesting piece of that trial are the alienists. An alienist is a term. It's an old school term that is used for a mental health professional who is there to determine criminal culpability. And they sat in and listened to the trial, and then they testified to the various interviews they had with Waite. There were several of them. The prosecution had hired a couple, and the defense had hired a couple. And Waite is such a good liar, and he lied so often. And with the ring of truth, it's hard to know exactly where, like I said before, the line is between fact and fiction with him. But when you look at what he told his alienists, somewhere in there is the real Arthur Warren Waite. He goes into why he committed the murders. And probably the most fascinating piece of the testimony of the alienists is why he rejected Clara and why he loved Margaret Horton. And essentially, he says that Clara was just simply too practical. Not ethereal is the word, whereas Margaret Horton was much more romantic, a lover of the arts and things. Also, very fascinating witness was Arthur Warren Waite himself. It's kind of fun to try to figure out where he's lying and where he's telling the truth because he was so adept at lying. But also his testimony is interesting because at various points in time, he threw in a smile and a laugh and a chuckle in places where it would be completely inappropriate for a quote unquote normal individual to do. So, example, he talks about spiking Hannah Peck's tea with Kelnel, and then he laughs, hysterically. And that was his way of trying to get the alienists in the audience to declare that he had to be insane. And ultimately, one juror was interviewed after the trial said that it was that smile that condemned him because he went too far overboard in trying to play the role of the insane individual.
So he's sentenced to death.
Yeah. He's sentenced to die, and in fact does take the long walk to Sing Sing's electric chair in 1917, in May. I think the date is May 24th.
In the days leading up to his execution, you write that he's pretty calm. The doctor measures his blood pressure, and it's normal. He has a nice last meal with his brother Frank, and they talk about old times. And then the guard comes to get him, and he basically breaks down.
Yeah, the knees buckle a little bit, and I think that there's a little bit of a psychological torture going on with that. Those old movies where they show like death row inmates, they're sitting in their cells and the lights will go dim right when they're using the chair. Well, in Sing Sing at the time, the death row cells, this is before they constructed their death house in 1922. They had the death house in Waite's era. Was one part of the prison where the cells that were attached, they were adjacent to the electric chair room through a door that was painted green. The little green door, although it was kind of faded by that point in time to like a burnished metal color. And it was just a short walk, although the convicts called it the long walk. But they tested the chair out prior to each execution, and it caused the lights to dim a little bit. So can you imagine how that would affect the mentality, you know? And I think that Waite was a consummate con man right to the end. He had convinced everybody that he was completely calm, and he might have been, but when they walked him through the door and he saw the chair, that's when he started to fall apart a little bit.
So Clara, after all of this, I mean, her life could easily have gone bad for her. She married a man who killed her parents. It's hard to imagine that guilt. But she ends up remarrying her childhood sweetheart, actually, and lives a long, healthy life.
Yeah, she married the man that Percy really wanted her to marry, a guy that was a stand-up guy that everybody liked, a very honest man. And in fact, he did. He was an usher, I think, for her marriage to Waite. They got married in California, and Caulfield his name was, and they had a few kids, and she did. She lived a good long life. Her descendants are remain in California to this day.
So for people who are interested in more information about your books and your blog, where should they go?
Yeah, it's called darkcornersofhistory.com, and I've launched essentially an exploration into the dark corners of history. I reveal through various sources, certain crimes, and they range from the earliest days of the U.S. government to the present day, although I tend to do a lot with the historical end. A lot of the stuff are stories that, you know, I wanted to write about but didn't necessarily have enough to devote an entire book to, and it's kind of interesting stuff. I know that, like, this book, the last book I wrote was a murder and mayhem in Grand Rapids, and there was a chapter I had to cut out for continuity's sake and for the sake of length. And it's about a boxer who kills another boxer in the ring here in Grand Rapids when it was prize fighting was a crime, and they were going to go after him for murder. And that chapter I put up online on the Dark Corners of History site. It's kind of an interesting piece of U.S. history, so... Yeah, that's Dark Corners of History.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much. I've had a lot of fun doing it.
This again is the Most Notorious podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.